I'm Divya Shekhar, and this is From the Bookshelves of Forbes India. A few days ago, I had the honor of speaking with Madhav Gadgil, one of the most eminent ecologists in India, about his recently released memoir, A Walk Up the Hill. Gadgil grew up around trees and forests in Pune and knew at the age of 14 that he wanted to be a field ecologist. During his career, among other achievements, he led the program on the development of Western Ghats for several years and has given many valuable insights related to planning and policy making at the Ghats. He also led a Save Western Ghats campaign in the 1980s to create awareness among people residing there and to draw attention of officials towards issues emerging at the Ghats. He was a professor of ecology at Harvard University and has founded the Center for Ecological Sciences at the Indian Institute of Science in Bengaluru. All through his career, Madhav Gadgil has been a people's conservationist. He has set an example of working close to people and communities on the ground, roping in researchers, policymakers, NGOs, farmers, teachers, students, and citizens. He has conducted many innovative experiments, research, and policy work towards building an inventory and monitoring biodiversity in this country. Welcome to the podcast, Mr. Gadgil.
Thank you.
The committee that you led for the conservation of the Western Ghats and its recommendations, they marked a watershed moment in environmental conservation and policy in India. And over the years, various climate-related disasters have shown us that we have ignored those recommendations at our own peril. So what do you have to say about what has happened to the Western Ghats, the deterioration that we see there? And because a common thread in your book is this tug of war between development and conservation.
Our report had argued that the development and nature conservation decisions should not be imposed from the top. This will lead to very bad decisions. And we should take both the scientific evidence into account and take the inputs from the local level on board and make the decisions. Right. That has not been happening. And essentially, as I have argued, what is being done is people are being excluded both from decisions relating to nature conservation and development. And the benefits of development are reaching a very small section at the cost of nature and people.
Yeah.
We had argued that this should not happen. Unfortunately, it has been happening. And more and more people are becoming aware of it because of the increasing intensity of floods and landslides and so on over the years. And nowadays, of course, people have realized the issue relating to warming of the earth and so on. So there is certainly quite an awareness and an interest in what we had said.
Right.
Now, it is really silly, but in Kerala, actually, there were articles saying that a prophet had come. Madhav Gadgil and predicted this was going to happen. You can say scientists with some understanding, but this is ridiculous. But apparently people in Kerala had, there were these serious floods in 2018-19,
yes,
and some landslides had reacted to this, that this should have been taken into on board. And even recently when in Maharashtra there was this major landslide, in the legislative assembly, there was debate and it was suggested that our report should have been taken on board and so on.
Right.
So there is now clearly increasing awareness, and I hope kind of the substantial body of facts and experiences, and then based on that, certain interpretations which I have put in the book will help people to arrive at some proper decisions.
In fact, my next question is about the involvement of bureaucracy in institutions in matters related to the environment when it comes to the freedom of telling things as they are. When you joined the Indian Institute of Science in Bengaluru in 1973, Satish Dhawan, the man who helped shape India's space program, was the director. And you write in the book about how he set an example of how a leader stands by his people. Can you tell us that story of how he backed you up when government officials wanted you to take down a particular article that you had written for the Deccan Herald? I think the article was about your observations from a trek for 5 days from Bandipur Tourist Lodge to Nagarhole in Karnataka.
When I joined Indian Institute of Science in 73, I started writing articles in Deccan Herald, which I continued all along. So I had written three articles describing the experiences of this trek. Mm. And I had made certain criticisms of how a very good natural forest had been cut down on the assumption that the productivity will be improved by teak plantation.
Yeah.
And the teak plantation had failed because of the parasites growing on the trees. And this was a pity. So the forest officers were unhappy, but you know, they kept quiet. Then as soon as the emergency was declared in 75, I guess it is, that I got a letter within 2 weeks, actually, two weeks later, from the forest head, chief conservator's office, that I am ordered not to write anything for publication before it is cleared by the forest department.
Yes.
So I was annoyed.
Yeah.
And what do you mean that I cannot write? I am not going to be tied by these people. So I was very unhappy. I went to Dhawan because I knew he would support me if it was clear that I was right in what I was doing.
Mm.
So I told him, I showed him that letter, and he asked me, what is the provocation? I gave him the article to read. So he said, I will read it. And he found time. I mean, he was a busy man, but next morning he called me and he said, you can cite a chapter and verse for exactly where this plantation is, and anybody can go and check. I said, of course I know.
Mm-hmm.
I will do it. So he said, fine, you simply ignore this letter. Mm-hmm. Let's see what they will do. And so that was the end. So they realized that if I'm continuing to ignore the letter, I must have backing of person like Dhawan, who had really a very great sort of prestige influence in the country as a bureaucrat of, and by that time he was also heading the space department, you know, that nobody can do anything.
Right.
So
these days, do you see strong voices like this standing up for the environment, strong leaders like this? Or is that something that we lack or we need?
There are, of course, people, and increasingly people who are standing up and talking about the environmental cause. We need certainly more and more of those. But I think those of the caliber of M.K. Prasad of this, you know, Silent Valley fame, there are fewer and fewer with real, I think, but most of those who are talking about it are not connected to the people very much. M.K. Prasad was very much a man of the people.
Mm.
Most of those who are writing today are mostly English educated and relatively little contact with the people at the ground level.
Correct.
And none of them, unlike M.K. Prasad and all these, or Chandi Prasad, but none of them will write in any Indian language.
Mm.
Those who are sort of bilingual writers are fewer and fewer.
Yeah. In fact, one of the suggestions that you give in the last chapter is that one of the key to conservation in India, or one of the key to empowering people, is to give them rights over the natural resources of their own locality. Like, yes, you cite the example of Pachgaon,
yes,
a village in Chandrapur district of Maharashtra.
Yeah.
What are the challenges now that communities and people face in getting disclosures about what is being done to the land around them, or to the forests, or to the resources around them? Because we saw, I think, in 2021 that there were amendments that were being made to the EIA, the Act, and there was no disclosure, there was no conversation that was carried on with the people before the amendments were made. So what are your thoughts on that?
See, there is now twofold developments. One is that, yes, the official machinery is trying to suppress more and more any kind of open public discourse. But the newer technological developments are quite have a quite opposite effect, that you now have more and more access to information and more easy communication with each other. For example, I am working with these young boys in Gadchiroli who are involved in community forest management. Some of them are, as I mentioned about this Sadhuram, even 10th standard failed, though very intelligent and capable persons. Now there is a possibility that I can be here in Pune, and there are others, you know, in different small villages in Gadchiroli district. Villages, in fact, which are under Naxalite influence. I mean, there is violence goes on off and on. But with the Zoom or Google Meet, we are talking fluently to each other.
Yeah.
And then they are having, their own other networks are being developed.
Right.
Then through the Google images and so on, what is the reality is being disclosed. I have mentioned there that Kuttikkal village,
yes,
where there was this very horrific landslide, and the government said there are, I forget the exact numbers, they are there. There are only three, maybe quarries. And actually from Google image, you can see 13 and so on. I mean, you have now access to information. You have now possibilities of intercommunication, which are at a very different, qualitatively different level, And then you can take with the smartphone, anybody can take pictures of what is going on there, and you can upload them on the internet, and they are accessible. So while there is this attempt to blank out information, there is, these developments are making possible transparency. And I think, I am very hopeful that ultimately the attempt to blank out will fail.
Right.
It may take some time, but it will fail. And people will have access to good information, and they will be able to exert more and more pressure towards a more positive, proper, both operation of democracy and management of environment.
In fact, speaking of access, I want to ask you about the People's Biodiversity Register and the Biological Diversity Act. Here, I want to read out a few lines from the foreword of your book, which was written by agricultural scientist Mr. M.S. Swaminathan. He wrote, and I quote, "Madhav's suggestion on the inclusion of a People's Biodiversity Register in the Biological Diversity Act became an important tool for managing biological diversity across local bodies in the country. The National Biodiversity Authority that was subsequently established continues to use this tool for decision-making, especially around elements of access and benefit-sharing. Professor Gadgil, how is the People's Biodiversity Registry helping communities on the ground today?
Unfortunately, as I said, the bureaucracy doesn't want people to get empowered. So they have formulated rules which have completely subverted the purpose. And it is not happening. But there are these exceptions. And a very remarkable exception was that of Kardar, a panchayat which I mentioned, where they prepared the biodiversity register as per the original act and not as mangled by the rules. And it talked about the impact of the rock quarries in the area on the biodiversity, on the ecosystem. The Kerala State Biodiversity Board was asked to check on the factual accuracy of this report, and it was found to be accurate enough. And so, actually, there was a High Court petition, and the High Court asked the quarrying to be stopped. Yeah. So, there was this very positive experience, and that is, Kardar is very close to Kuttikkal, where later this very serious death toll was taken by landslides.
Mm.
Anyway, so otherwise, there were experimental districts, but not formally, properly recognized. And there has been no real interest in any local people undertaking that, because all that the rules are saying is that their intellectual property will be, taken away from them.
Mm.
So this is the unfortunate position. I hope that there will be more and more in future examples like this Kadanad Panchayat, and things will change. But so far, no.
Right. So right now, according to you, what are the biggest challenges in environmental conservation in India? What are the biggest challenges that we face today, and how can we sort of overcome them?
I think the biggest challenge, as I have said, is the divide in our society.
Hmm.
The educated, influential classes in the urban areas are prejudiced in thinking that it is the rural people, is the farmer, it's the Adivasis and the fisher folk and everybody else who are making a living out of natural resources, that they are destroying the environment.
Right.
And the only way is to bureaucratically use the guns and guards approach to protect the environment, which is empirically, if you look at the situation, a completely wrong picture of what is going on in the country.
Mm.
And it is this, if the divide in the society of, this kind of prejudice against the majority of the people, hopefully with more and more education reaching the people at large and technology, this will slowly get bridged.
Mm.
But that, I think, is the major challenge, is this divide in the society.
So what should India do from a regulatory standpoint now? And what do businesses need to learn when it comes to bringing in climate consciousness in the way they operate? Who can they look towards? Like in your book, for example, you talk about the lessons that we can take from, say, South Korea.
South Korea was devastated by a war. Essentially, its economy destroyed, hundreds of thousands of people killed. But on getting back away from the war, when the war was concluded, then they definitely really focused on education and healthcare and reaching that out to everybody. And on that basis, then they built later all this strength, you know, of the Hyundai and the, what is this? I have a
Samsung.
LG and Samsung, all that. So that was built on that strength. Now, we have not done that.
So basically, you're saying that we need to focus on strengthening our healthcare and education systems from the grassroots and have a bottom-up approach, right? Yeah.
And secondly, as far as businesses are concerned, I have also mentioned that the businesses are used to excessive levels of subsidies. The paper industry, I have mentioned because I was asked to study paper industry. So when the market rate for the bamboo was 1500 rupees per ton at that time, they were given bamboo at 1.5 rupees.
Means
they are being given these huge subsidies.
Yeah.
And these huge subsidies, and they are allowed to pollute. There is no serious checking of pollution and any kind of penalties. And so with these kind of subsidies, they have no interest in actually becoming efficient.
Yeah.
And that is the problem, I think. The industries, if they become genuinely efficient, then we will not be inviting Samsung to start, give them land here. Again, you know, at the cost of farmers who often protest, and ask them to set up factories.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we do that? I think this is, to my mind, the two issues. This kind of a divide in the society and the improper subsidies that are making the industry, same way with the mining and so on, completely improper subsidies which are making them so inefficient and certainly quite uncompetitive on the world market. So you look at the balance of payments.
Hmm.
India has amongst the most negative balance of payments in the world.
Yeah.
So how are we driving the progress? By continually asking for more and more foreign investment.
Mm.
Now, you should not, the foreign investment should not be the foundation of the economy of a country. You look at South Korea, it has the one of the most positive balances of payment. They export far more than they import.
Yeah.
We should be moving towards that, to my mind.
Right. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. It was wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you.
And to all our listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode. I had a wonderful time speaking with Mr. Gadgil. I'm Divya Shekhar. See you next time.